Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. When Western capitals face what is deemed a foreign policy dilemma, the go-to position is something must be done, even if that something is counterproductive and dangerous. This is now happening when it comes to Ukraine. Something must be done means escalation. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, Garland Nixon in Washington. He's a political analyst. In Percival, we have Philip Giraldi. He's a former CIA counterterrorism specialist who is now executive director of the Council for the National Interest. And in Budapest, we cross to George Samueli. He is a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Okay, let's start with Philip here. Obviously, we're all watching the events very closely unfold, what's going on in Ukraine. We saw the Ukrainian president address, essentially it would be a joint session of Congress. He's talked to the Canadian Parliament, the UK Parliament. And that is a very powerful propaganda element that is being played out in this conflict. Because I watch a lot of cable TV, I don't really see much of a conflict. I hear a whole lot of commentary. So, Philip, is the West at war with Russia? I mean, minus the nukes at this point, but it's never really said straightforward, but this is war.
Well, I would agree. I mean, just based on the economic warfare that is being waged against Russia right now, to me, that's war. Arming the Ukrainians in a very obvious and open way and calling for the assassination of a foreign head of state and other gimmicks that are coming out of our U.S. Congress, to me, are all de facto war. And it is, in fact, I think, the Russian side that's being restrained here. Those of us who are unfortunately living in the United States, we hear a constant stream of propaganda coming out of government and both and also the talking heads on the media. And we're not hearing the other side. One of the funny things about all this is that as a former intelligence officer myself, when you're trying to sell something like this, you sell a narrative. And the key to the narrative is where you start the narrative. Right. So everything we see on television starts this whole thing 3 months ago and doesn't go back to 2014 when the United States engaged in regime change in Ukraine and basically started this whole thing. Nobody's talking about that.
Yeah, it's called context, and it's completely absent from what we're being fed. George, I need your help. I need you to explain something to me, because if you look at the broadsheets in the UK, cable in the United States, it's all about escalation, 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 what should be done, something must be done, as they always say. But if you read the Russian media and you read the Ukrainian media, two countries that are at war right now, there's a lot of stress on how to end this conflict as soon as possible. And, you know, there's different, a 15-point proposal, 18 hours of discussions, some progress, but not much. We're going to meet again. That's what we're hearing here. And then I watch Fox News, and it's just a lead up to the Third World War. So, of course, we don't want to do that, but everything they're doing and talking about is leading to that. George, explain that to me.
Well, it's very hard to explain because it does seem as if the strategy of the United States and the United Kingdom is to escalate and to exacerbate and to keep the war going for as long as possible. Now, I guess there may be a calculation there that, well, the longer we keep this going, the worse it's going to get for Russia. And after all, that's what we're supposed to be about. We're trying to destroy Russia. We're going to try to bring it to its knees. So if it goes on for month after month, and it's going to be bad for Russia, therefore it must be good for us. But even in those narrow terms, it's actually going to be an absolute calamity for Europe and eventually the United States if this war goes on. I mean, if these arms that they're sending there get into the wrong hands, and we have this massive migrant flow, who even knows who exactly is now pouring out of Ukraine? We're told that 3 million refugees have left Ukraine. That's an awful lot of people in just a few days. Nobody knows who these people are. And if they're coming to Europe with weapons, with gangland connections and so on, you know, Europe is going to suffer. We've already known something about the effect of blowback. But the other aspect of it is that if you escalate, you get into very serious problems. I mean, we have people coming on cable. Oh, let's send them, javelin missiles. Let's send them surface-to-air missiles. Let's send them the man pads. You know, they'll know what to do with them. Okay, you try to get them in. Russia bombs any convoy. They've already said we will bomb any convoy. Then what? What's the next step? How far are you going to take it? You know, you're going to start shooting down Russian planes that threaten the convoys. They don't really think, you know, you're just one step ahead. They just like these ridiculous sound bites and the opportunities to get on cable and to sound off.
Yeah, I mean, Garland, it sounds like they want this conflict to go on until the last Ukrainian is dead or left the country. Because, you know, there is no context of it being presented to the public here. One of the things that's very painful from, I live in Moscow, obviously, and, you know, this war is awful. All wars are awful. But there was a war going on in the eastern part of Ukraine, is called the Donbass, for 8 years, where people were being slaughtered. That was never or hardly ever made mention in the mainstream. Of course, specialists would talk about it at great length, but the average consumer of news probably is barely aware of the word Donbass and probably even less aware that there was a conflict there, that up to 15,000 people, overwhelmingly civilians, were killed. But that's not part of the narrative. Go ahead, Garland.
Yes, and here's the way I view this. You know, I've been reading that the U.S. is saying that State Department is saying, well, we can still do our pivot to Asia. So is it a war? Okay, I'll put it like this. The U.S. empire sees this as one of the battles in a larger war to maintain world hegemony. That they're so I don't really think they want to get entangled in a kinetic war with Russia. And as we know, historically, these things have happened accidentally. They want to entangle Russia up in this. They want to severely damage Russia so they can turn to China. And meanwhile, of course, the other fronts like Africa, to try to separate the countries in Africa from Russia and China economically. So it's part of a broader war. And the information war, in my opinion, is an information war against the citizens of the West, against the Americans and the Europeans. They have to convince the Americans and the Europeans that this is not, that they have to hide from them what they're really doing and create an environment where the citizens of the West see a villain and a hero, and the U.S. is the cowboy riding in to save the Ukrainian people or the Taiwanese people or whatever, et cetera. Because if the American people and the European people knew the truth about the insidious plans of their leaders, they wouldn't accept it.
You know, Philip, again, being a concern, because it's part of my job, I have to watch what's going on in the news. And for the past almost 3 weeks now, I've been watching officials. These officials that come on TV, they're very familiar to me. I remember them back in 2003. Okay, I remember them talking, it's going to be a cakewalk, you know, it'll pay for itself. Of course, I'm referencing Iraq. So, Philip, I mean, why should any person that is a consumer of news and against these foreign wars believe any of these lieutenant colonels and generals and, you know, the people from think tank land? You know, I mean, they're all the same faces and they all say the same thing over and over again, and they have a record of utter complete failure. Explain to us, Philip.
Well, I really can't explain it. I mean, the thing is, I've been watching the same clowns also since 2003 and left the government for that reason. The fact is, these people have been peddling lies going back as far as Lyndon Johnson, if not before. And people have gotten used to it, I'm afraid. They don't want to believe it sometimes. But at the same time, they're kind of Americans. They're living here. They feel that they have to support the government. It's that kind of funny mindset. In this case, I mean, the propaganda has been relentless, and it's also been very good. I noticed in the speech Zelensky made to the U.S. Congress, it was a totally coached speech. He was hitting every nail on the head. He probably had four neocon advisors standing behind him, whispering in his ear. And it was, this is a very sophisticated effort by the people who want war for one reason or another. And most people get conned by it. And that's the unfortunate reality. There is a big kind of counterculture, myself included, that is speaking up very strongly in the other direction, but we don't have access to the media. We don't have access to any source that basically gets us out to multi-millions of people and explains that this is just not the way it is.
Yeah.
Peter, if I may make a quick comment,
jump in,
just very brief, and that is this. And as again, I don't think they really want kinetic war or no-fly zone or whatever. But if they bring Zelensky in and he asks for all of these over-the-top things, when Joe Biden doesn't do it, he appears to be showing restraint. And so now you have a situation where people say, well, you can't say that he's some kind of a neocon warmongering madman. Why, look at the restraint. So they ask for a lot. And then when he still does terrible things, it appears to be less than they asked for.
It's kind of very counterintuitive. But my question to all three of you and to my viewers, billions and billions and billions of dollars have been pumped into Ukraine since 2014. I'd like to know where it's gone. George, let me go to you now. It's interesting, when you look at like a responsible statecraft and these, antiwar.com, these places, and they're valuable, okay? There is this dissent allowed. And they're talking about Ukrainian neutrality based on Austria, on Finland, and not joining military blocs. I'm sorry, George, we distinctly remember you being on this program where we're saying, that would be a good idea because then it would avoid a conflict. I mean, this is exasperating, George. Go ahead.
Yes, it really is. And, what we have had really since the Biden administration, because I think the Biden administration, when the history of this is written, the culpability of the Biden administration will feature very prominently. From the beginning, it has pushed for membership of NATO for Ukraine. From the beginning, it has basically told Ukraine, don't bother with Minsk. It's not a good deal. You can get something much better if you stick with us. We're going to get you into NATO. We're going to sponsor some kind of a military offensive, which will be bad for Russia. It will humiliate Russia. Stick with us, kid. It has led to this disaster. And unfortunately, these websites that you mentioned, they don't really, appreciate the full extent of which, the Russians have shown remarkable patience. I mean, you can condemn them, all you like, but this comes as a result of a very long sequence of events starting in 2014, but even before that.
George, we got to go to a hard break, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on some real issues. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the Home Edition. To remind you, we're discussing some real issues. Okay, let's go back to Garland. Watching a lot of the punditry, and I'm a Fox News consumer, and I don't deny that to people. Garland, George W. Bush has finally succeeded. His legacy has been polished, okay? Because the Republicans and the Democrats are all in lockstep. It feels so eerily like the post 9/11, right before the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. It's the same people, it's the same rhetoric, it's the same exceptionalism. Something must be done, and we're the only ones that can do it. And we had a cascade of failures after that, but that doesn't seem to matter. Explain to me how that is.
Well, because these people don't have another option. This is who they are, and this is what they do. You know, if you look at Victoria Nuland, she was Dick Cheney's assistant. Then she was in the Obama administration under Hillary Clinton. Then she wasn't in the Trump administration, but he had John Bolton. So he had just had a different iteration of Victoria Nuland, and now she's back. You know, some people initially called Joe Biden's administration, you know, this is going to be the second Obama administration. My opinion is, no, it's the fourth Bush administration. That since the Bush administration, I mean, the fact of the matter is, you know, I'm no Trump fan, but the reality is I saw Donald Trump as trying to pump the brakes to some extent, as and still as hawkish as he was in comparison to these people, he was trying to pump the brakes a little bit. And that's why they tried to take him out. So what we're looking at is basically in the U.S., we've got the hawks. Excuse me. We've got the super hawks and the ultra hawks. We don't even have any hawks anymore. And their game plan is we control everything. In fact, let me add this. Even when they need Venezuela and Iran, they don't even have the ability to turn the volume down enough to go ask for something that they desperately need. They have to go to people that they need something from and make demands. They're going to go to Venezuela and say, we need your oil, but you're going to have a a new election. These people are, I mean, it's just twisted.
Well, I thought Guaido was president. Why are they talking to Maduro? I don't get that. Okay, anyway, Guaido has all the gold. Maybe they should talk to him, okay, because they stole it from Venezuela. Philip, what is the future of NATO? Because in my opinion, the event of February 24th, Russia's military operation in Ukraine, it really is the tombstone of NATO. NATO was supposed to keep the peace, and it failed utterly. What's it for right now? Go ahead.
Well, I mean, NATO was created basically as a military alliance, a hostile military alliance directed against the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. And as far as I'm concerned, when 1991 rolled around, NATO should have had the sense to abolish itself. That didn't happen for a number of reasons. There are all kinds of myths that float around about why the United States felt it was necessary to continue to have NATO. One of them, of course, is the argument that the U.S. basically believes in global dominance. And essentially, Europe is the key to this. Europe is the when you need a few more soldiers to go to Afghanistan or to go to Libya or to go to Serbia, NATO is there for this purpose. So they're proxies for the United States. The United States is in big trouble. I think that a lot of the wars could be explained in terms of the economics, the fact that the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency is under challenge. And if that goes, then the U.S. as a major player will also go, because the ability to spend $1 trillion on what they call defense depends on being able to go to the Treasury and just tell them to print the money. So I think there are a lot of vulnerabilities that some people in Washington are focusing on. But in a way, these are false vulnerabilities that the U.S. has created itself.
Yeah, well, and also, I mean, we could always throw in with NATO expansion. It was a really good grip for the arms industry, okay, because you got to buy American arms, okay. George, one of the most important issues that come about as a result of Russia's military operation in Ukraine is China. And there's, you know, to what degree China is in agreement or just refusing to say anything against it. There's a lot in play right here. And we had this declaration when Putin went to Beijing for the opening of the Olympic Games. It was a pretty hefty document, George. It wasn't done on the fly, okay? Talking about a strategic relationship. And there's a lot of shifts going on right now. Philip is right. I think the petrodollar is in really big trouble when, after a half century of Saudi Arabia being a loyal vassal, the Saudis have decided to stand up on their own because they can do it, okay? Why do countries do that? What they do? Because they can, okay? And the Chinese are very quietly watching all of this unfold. I agree with Garland, maintaining and solidifying hegemony. But that kind of hegemony is a Pyrrhic victory, because if Europe will just be crushed by all of this, okay? They want energy security by 2030. Well, good luck, guys, okay? It's the here and now.
Go ahead.
No, that's right. I mean, I think if we can identify this point as the end of the post-Cold War era, which means that it's the end of the unipolar moment, the end of the a world led by United States. And, you know, we're going back to, let's say, the Cold War era with the two blocks. This time, the United States is in a much weaker position than it was in the first Cold War, because in the first Cold War, okay, the Soviet Union was the military equal of the United States, but the United States dominated the world economy, world finance. No one could challenge that. And China was fairly insignificant, both militarily and economically. Now, in this new, let's say it's a two-block world, Russia and China together is a very, very formidable alliance. You've got a great military power from Russia, and now you have serious economic and financial power from China, and they are definitely going to challenge American financial supremacy, and they're already doing it. I mean, it's the instance that you sound of Saudi Arabia, which is now going to be trading in yuan instead of dollar, and there's going to be an awful lot of that. Countries are going to start thinking, well, what do we need have dollars for? I mean, the United States can, you know, at a moment's notice, just seize our dollar assets. I mean, just like that, you know, from one day to the next, they grab the dollar assets, and, you know, we won't be able to trade at all in the world. So there's no incentive for countries now to buy dollars. That's a real problem. So I think, you know, in this post Cold War world, the United States will not be in a good shape.
Caroline, it's I think China is probably the most keen observer of what's going on, because Russia is the first G20 country ever to be sanctioned like this. Okay, and it's it is an important in every single sense of the global economy, finance. It's a significant player. It's the first one ever to be sanctioned like this. The Chinese are watching this because they have their own issues, and they want to see how the Russians react, see what works and what doesn't work. I think this is part of the strategic relationship the two countries have. Your take, go ahead.
Yeah, yes, and you know, something interesting about this too, another interesting dynamic, and that is, you know, in a parliamentary system, sometimes you'll have a small party that'll, you know, only have six or seven MPs, but they can be the kingmaker, as it were, right? Now, other countries, India is one I've been watching. You look at India, you're looking at Saudi Arabia, and they're finding that because there's an opening for them to choose, do I want to go with the West? Do I want to go with China, Russia, blah, which block they want to go with, that they're able to punch above their weight. Saudi Arabia now, the U.S. is probably, you know, on their knees begging them, please, you know, don't do this. So it's empowering other countries to be more powerful than they thought they were in the past, because they can choose the coalition. The other thing is, it's kind of smoked the U.S. out into as to what they'll do if they really feel desperate. And so a lot of countries have to be looking at this, corporations, wealthy people, countries have to be looking at this saying, uh-oh, if I let the EU and the U.S. hold my wallet, they might not give it back. So now people are thinking, How can I kind of quietly shift my resources and shift my sovereign wealth funds and my holdings out of the East? I guarantee there's going to be a lot of capital flight from the West. And I've seen it from people that I know.
You know, Philip, you've been on Crosstalk many times with me and other guests, and I always mention the learning curve. And, you know, we are always told, you know, we won't do that again. Oh, we learned our lesson from Vietnam. We learned our lesson from Iraq. But it never happens. I mean, is it institutional inertia? Is it just grifts? Is it ideology? Because as we all agree here, and, you know, there's conservatives and progressives on this program here, this is just bad for the U.S. and for the Western world. Every single scenario, you game it out, they lose. But you never get that from cable TV. Go ahead, Philip.
Well, I think the reason for that is actually quite simple. I've often complained when I write articles and that sort of thing that about how the United States government system, as it has evolved since the Second World War, has no accountability built into it. These people are never held accountability for what they do. George W. Bush is an esteemed elder statesman now. Obama Likewise. I mean, you know, when does it all end? I mean, this just keeps to go on and on and on, and they're never held to account. If they're never held to account, they're going to repeat the same mistakes over and over again as they personally get rich and as they personally make the people who are donors to them get rich. And you go on from, you know, president to president with the same thing. As was commented earlier, Donald Trump went against the system because he just gave a little inkling that he might not be interested in following the formula. And apart from that, Trump was not a very good president. But the fact is, this sent the shockwaves through the system. And we need accountability. We need some of these people to go to jail.
But, you know, Philip, you really hit, I think, at the core of it all, because, I mean, you mentioned it, and it's something that I've really noticed. I mean, if you look at, particularly, you know, after the end of the Cold War, you have people that were in government and they work for these, you know, think tanks and the arms builders and all that. And it just seems like it's not really about ideology. It's about personal wealth. I mean, that's, I'm sorry. It sounds very, very straightforward to be that. It's just greed.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. Very often it is greed. How is it that all these congressmen who go into Congress from relatively modest backgrounds, spend 22 years in Congress and come out as multimillionaires? How did that happen?
Yeah, well, we're rapidly running out of time, gentlemen, here. But I want to say one thing important is that I told Philip before the program, it wouldn't be a good program unless his dog showed up. His dog has shown up. It is over his shoulder here. And I feel we have a full complement on this program. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. I want to thank my guests in Washington, Purcellville, and in Budapest. I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.